course, is well known as the pastor of St. Michael's. Been a priest since 1986. Today he will be speaking to you about true Catholic social justice. Please welcome to the lectern Father Casimir Pascoris.
I probably should begin by explaining that because I'm taller, I need to give the talk down here, otherwise the whiteboard would be too low. So this is the tall priest version of a talk. The short priest version would be up there. Perhaps you're wondering how this topic or this particular talk originated, and I'll be honest and say that I suggested it for the Fatima conference because it is part of our Catholic faith to understand virtue and holiness, and this is a matter of the virtue of justice, so it definitely is a topic to talk about. I will admit, obviously, that I'm not an expert in this regard, but I have often touched upon this topic in the classes I've taught through the years in high school or maybe in some theology class when we happen to talk about it. And I believe it's a very relevant topic because we see the world going towards a socialist economy. You know what? I want to identify what is wrong, what's right, and even though I'm not an expert, I will appeal to the highest experts that we have as Catholics, the Living Magisterium, in particular Pope Leo XIII and Pope Pius XI. Anyway, a little bit of humor is a good thing, and I wanted to start off with something you may have seen in an email that, you know, one of these emails that gets circulated. It's the two-cow system of economics. And I think that will be a nice little intro here. So, here is socialism. You have two cows. The government takes one and gives one to your neighbor. Communism. You have two cows. The government takes them both and promises you milk, but you starve. Fascism. You have two cows. The government takes them and sells you the milk. Bureaucracy. You have two cows. The government takes them both, shoots one, milks the other, pays you for the milk, and then pours it down the drain. Capitalism. You have two cows, you sell one and buy a bull, and you raise a herd. Okay. There's a couple of other, or a few other ways of looking at it. The Christian economic system of charity. You have two cows, you keep one and give one to your neighbor. A Republican. You have two cows, your neighbor has none. So what? A Democrat, you have two cows, your neighbor has none. You feel guilty for being successful. You vote people into office who tax your cows, forcing you to sell one to raise money to pay the tax. The people you voted for then take the tax money and buy a cow and give it to your neighbor and you feel righteous. Is it okay if I use a little bit of ethnic humor here? Okay. A French corporation. You have two cows, you go on strike because you want three cows. A Japanese corporation. You have two cows, you redesign them so they are one-tenth the size of an ordinary cow and produce 20 times the milk. A German corporation. You have two cows, you re-engineer them so they live for 100 years, eat once a month, and milk themselves. The only downside is they want 16 weeks vacation every year. An Italian corporation. Well, this one might really get me into trouble. You have two cows, but you don't know where they are. You spot a beautiful woman, you take a break for lunch, life is good. A Russian corporation. You have two cows, you count them and learn you have five cows. You count them again and you learn you have 42 cows. You need to put the vodka away. One last one, a Swiss corporation. You have 5,000 cows, none of which belong to you. You charge for storing them for others. The Swiss bank theory. Anyway, on a more serious note now, I'd just like to take you to a couple of fables or stories that get across the right idea when it comes to working. The ants and the grasshopper. The ants were spending a fine winter's day drying grain collected in the summertime. A grasshopper, perishing with famine, passed by and earnestly begged for a little food. The ants inquired of him, "Why did you not treasure up food during the summer?" He replied, "I had not leisure enough. I passed the days in singing." The ants then said in derision, "If you were foolish enough to sing all the summer, you must dance supperless to bed in the winter." And then there's the story of the little red hen. And I won't read the whole thing. You've heard it, no doubt. But it's about the little red hen that wants to plant wheat and starts asking around the barnyard for help. "Who will help me to plant my wheat?" "Not I," said the cow. "Not I," said the duck. "Not I," said the pig. "Not I," said the goose. "Then I will do it by myself." She planted her crop, and the wheat grew and ripened. "Who will help me reap my wheat?" And as the story goes, nobody has any interest in helping her reap. Nobody has any interest in helping her to grind the wheat. Nobody has any interest in harvesting it, baking the bread. But by the time the fresh baked bread arrives, it attracts everybody in the barnyard. They saw the bread and wanted some. In fact, they demanded a share, but the little red hen said, "No, I shall keep them." "Excess profits," cried the cow. "Capitalist leech," screamed the duck. "I demand equal rights," yelled the goose. "Share with the 99%, grunted the pig. And they all painted unfair picket signs and marched around and around the little red hen shouting obscenities. Then the farmer came and said to the little red hen, "You must not be so greedy." "But I earned the bread," said the little red hen. "Exactly," said the farmer. "That is what makes our free enterprise system so wonderful. Anyone in the barnyard can earn as much as he wants. But under our modern government regulations, the productive workers must divide the fruits of their labor with those who are idle." But of course, in this fairy tale, this is just a fairy tale. In the real world version, the little red hen doesn't want to bake bread anymore. And then everybody suffers when they realize there's no more bread. What these two little stories point to is to a duty and a necessity that everybody has. And I wanted to begin with this to set the table, so to speak, or set the scene for our understanding of what true social justice is. And that includes necessarily that a person must work for his living. A person must work to support himself. It is the natural law. And what's I find very interesting is that even before God created Eve, he placed Adam in the Garden of Paradise to tend it. So that makes gardening the first official human occupation. Even in his preternatural state, God did not want Adam to be idle, and he commanded him to work. And then it became even more of a necessity, and indeed also a penance after the fall. But here's another teaching on this. It's not just from the natural law. This is St. Paul's own teaching. You've heard in his second epistle to the Thessalonians, if a man will not work, neither let him eat. So nobody gets a free ride. If they're not able to work, that's a different matter entirely. But for everybody that can, this is an inescapable law. You must work. And we see this also in the context of the penance of daily duty. It's actually part of the Fatima message. Our Lord told Sister Lucia in subsequent apparitions to Our Ladies, the first penance I've come to ask is the penance of daily duty. But let me read just a few more verses from that chapter of 2 Thessalonians. This is the third chapter, and there's more to it that St. Paul is saying about the duty of work, and he talks about how he himself does his work. Even St. Paul the Apostle is not expecting a free ride. And remember the context here. In chapter 2, St. Paul talks about the great falling away, the great apostasy. We've talked about that many times in the context of what's going on today. But a byproduct, an unfortunate byproduct of waiting for the end times just to sit around and wait. So the same people that he told about the great falling away, he's also re-emphasizing the law of work. Chapter 3, verse 6 of 2 Thessalonians. And we charge you, brethren, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you withdraw yourselves from every brother walking disorderly, and not according to the tradition which they have received of us. For you yourselves know how you ought to imitate us. For we were not disorderly among you, neither did we eat any man's bread for nothing. But in labor and in toil we worked night and day, lest we should be chargeable to any of you. Not as if we had not power, but that we might give ourselves a pattern unto you to imitate us. For also when we were with you, this we declare to you, that if any man will not work, neither let him eat. For we have heard that there are some among you who walk disorderly, working not at all, but curiously meddling. Now we charge them that are such, and beseech them by the Lord Jesus Christ, that working with silence, they would eat their own bread. So I think we can establish unequivocally and most clearly the duty of work. And remember too that it is a sanctifying thing, it is a penance, and in embracing all the sacrifices in our daily duty, we are fulfilling the Fatima message as well. So, this is the point again. We have to work. Now, let's talk about justice. And there's three kinds of justice that we should be aware of. First of all, there's commutative justice, and that is what we owe to each other. And under this would come contracts, buying and selling, charging a just price, never defrauding, never cheating any of our fellow man. Then there's distributive justice. And this is what the state owes to its members, what the state owes. Well, let's say it's subjects. And then there's legal justice, and there's also sometimes difference of meaning attached to these, but these seem to be fairly common in the books. Legal is what the individual or what the subject owes to the state. And we have to recognize the fact, or I'm sure we do, that we are not just about radical individualism, every man fend for himself. We do have to live in society. It's the way God created us. It's our natural condition to have to be in a state, to have to have a government. It's not something we can escape. And there are, of course, many a false theory about this, among them the social contract theory, that you become a part of the state only if you enter into a free will agreement. That's not feasible and it's not correct. Just by the fact that we're human, we have to live in society. And, of course, inserting a spiritual point here, we have to live in the world but not be of the spirit of the world. This is our challenge, to keep fighting the spirit of the world, but that's on another subject. So anyway, so we've defined justice, and again, I'm not too worried about giving you the, you know, proving each point step by step. I think that's it's fairly obvious. And let's also understand that charity is not the same thing as justice. Justice is what I strictly owe to somebody. And charity goes beyond that. Goes beyond what I owe. And we have to practice both of these virtues. As a matter of fact, our Lord tells us that we will be judged on the last day according to our works of charity. The implication is there that we will have fulfilled our duties of justice, but we have to go over and beyond that. So let's practically apply, and I won't have time to write all this on the board, but practically, what does this mean? Injustice. What about my justice to God? I owe Him love and worship. I owe Him my life of prayer. You see, lacking prayer, the proper amount of prayer in our lives would in effect be a lack of justice to God. We're not giving to our Creator the duties we owe Him. And also to His church, supporting His church. I think it's correct to say that even our tithing, our support of the church, it comes under the heading of justice. Secondly, I pay my just debts and I do not incur needless debt. There's such a temptation for poor human nature to want to keep up with the Joneses and buy something that's beyond one's means. There are legitimate cases of going into debt to buy a house, to buy a car, but you know that has to be kept. Or you have to keep a real break on that. And you know, I haven't listened to a whole lot of Dave Ramsey, but I think he's got a lot of good ideas. You've heard about his plastic surgery, cutting up credit cards. Because too often there's spending beyond one's means and getting into a position of not being able to pay one's just debts. If you are an employer, paying a living wage to employees, this is a teaching that comes across, I'm going to talk about a little bit later, Pope Leo XIII and Pope Pius XI, they talked about this. They said, a man has to be able to support himself and his family on his wage. If he can't, how is he going to do it? So there is a very clear teaching on that, about a living wage that employers should pay, assuming they have the money, they have to be able to pay that. If you are an employee, giving an honest day's work for the pay you receive. Employers know that you don't work at top efficiency all day long, but overall, it has to be an honest day's work. Charging only a just price. This is another failing of human nature, that you know, if we can see that somebody really wants something and we take advantage of them by charging an unjust price, that is not morally permittable or permissible. We have to charge within the range of what would be considered a just price. And it's not a real concrete sort of thing where you can pick out a number and for each item in the world and say that's the just price. You have to go by common estimation. But it's pretty obvious that, you know, for example, this is a far out example, but let's say you're out in the desert and somebody's dying of thirst and you have water, and this person says, I'll pay you anything for water. And let's say it cost you $100 to bring a bottle of water out to that point in the desert. It would be immoral to charge $1,000 for that bottle of water. You're taking advantage of somebody's necessity and you're charging an unjust price. So what we're going to get at here and what the popes are saying is we must not make the laws of supply and demand the ultimate determinant of everything. The popes never condemn personal choice and the profit motive, but they're saying we have to remember we're talking about human beings. We can't give them the value of a commodity. And that's unfortunately what happened very clearly in the 19th century with the Industrial Revolution. And so don't to charge only just prices if we are in a position to be buying and selling. And again, there's that range as a low just price and a high just price. It has to be somewhere in there. And then the last part, which is obviously a very difficult thing to determine exactly, to pay just taxes. What's a just tax? Don't ask me. I am not in a position to say that, but I can tell you that the Catechism teaches, the Catholic Church teaches, that we should pay just taxes. And again, that's outside of my realm to start saying this is just, this is unjust. Although I can say that I can definitely see unjust taxation going on. So let's talk about now these two great popes, Pope Leo XIII and Pope Pius XI. And they wrote watershed encyclicals on the topic of social justice. And so the first one would be Pope Leo XIII in the famous encyclical Hererum Novarum, and I believe that was in 1891. And that's Latin for of new things. And it doesn't make sense just standing by itself, but the way encyclicals are titled is usually the first two or three words are the way to remember them. But I think the official title of this encyclical was On the Condition of the Working Man. And there was a condemnation of unbridled capitalism. What he was saying is that, and I'll repeat what I said earlier, the laws of supply and demand cannot be the ultimate determinants factors of morality. Because the laws of supply and demand work by themselves, whether it's a person, an animal, or a thing. And that's the problem. If we consider a person on any kind of level as being the same thing as a commodity. There's an inherent dignity in human beings. They have an eternal destiny. And so in this condemnation of unbridled capitalism, he insisted on a living wage and the right to form unions. And when you read of the 19th century, you read of just horrendous working conditions for laborers. And what was happening is, especially in the big corporations, the basically what it amounted to is the employer was saying, I'm going to pay you as little as possible. And if you can't make ends meet on that, tough luck. And so you had sometimes people working 12, 13, 14 hours a day. You had child labor. I mean, children working 12, 13 hours a day. There weren't the laws to prevent that kind of abuse of human beings going on. So Pope Leo XIII was very well aware of this, and he also talked about better opportunities. And I believe it was both he and Pope Pius XI that said, you have to realize that your working people are your real wealth. That if they can support themselves, and we're not talking about exorbitant wages, we're just talking about, you know, food, shelter, clothing, you know, being able to save up some money for the rainy day, for emergencies, for problems later on, and to have some money for recreation. He says, if people can have that and, of course, be taught to be happy with that, you've got a contented country. But in this 19th century, with the rise of industrialism, we also had communism breaking out. We had Karl Marx writing in 1848, the Communist Manifesto, workers of the world, unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains. And when people are oppressed, they will take oppression only so long. And they did rise up, and government after government after government was toppling during the 19th century. And not all of those would have happened if the needs of the working man were being properly addressed. So again, Pope Leo XIII was definitely trying to do that. And then 40 years later, Pope Pius XI wrote Quadragesimo Anno. And this is 1931. And Quadragesimo Anno, the 40th year, or in the 40th year. So he's absolutely referencing this encyclical to Rerum Novarum, and he's reaffirming, re-explaining, and emphasizing that, you know, to take care of the basic rights and needs of the worker. We need to do that. Now, I would say that this Quadragesimo Anno in particular would be, if you want to call it that, a social justice manifesto. Okay, he was talking about the need to be concerned about others in society, but, and this is a point I'm going to really hammer home, he was not condoning or teaching socialism. And that's what I've seen happen many a time. People will selectively quote from his encyclical and say, oh, this means we have to have, you know, tremendous social programs. You know, we really have to have the money, the government passing out money right and left. He did not say that. And I'll elaborate on this a little bit more. But also, I'm sure you recognize the date here, 1931. This is right in the depth, or the height or the depth, whatever you want to call it, of the Great Depression in our country. The stock market crashed in 1929. And we were going through some really hard times there in the 1930s. I don't know if that was necessarily true worldwide, but definitely in our country it was a hard time. And the Great Depression was a very agonizing time for many Americans. Unemployment was at 25%, and it just kept dragging on and dragging on. So it was a very difficult time. So what Pope Pius XI was doing was to not condemn the profit motive, nor to condemn choice. So I'd like to really emphasize, both these popes did not condemn the profit motive. after all, it's very motivating. Okay? So, and also did not condemn personal choice. Okay? So, we're going to see here very shortly that socialists twist the meanings of what these popes have said and also put in their own naturalistic view. So let's talk now about, in summary, what these two popes were stressing. And this is what is the true understanding of Catholic social justice. So I have to erase all of this. Any stars? I don't understand. Asterisk? No. Okay. So let's see what they emphasized. They emphasized private property. This is God-given. Nobody can take it away. Well, they'll try to take it away, but it will be inherent in human nature, the right to private property. It can never be abolished. God-given cannot be abolished. Now, they also recognize the right of the state to eminent domain. And we see that in our own constitution. The state, for example, if it's putting in a freeway, for example, this new north-south freeway, that's going to make it a lot easier for us to get to I-90 and go pick up people arriving for the Fatima conference. So that'll be a nice thing. But anyway, when they were buying up the land, they went up, knocked on people's doors and said, "We're buying this property," giving a fair market value for it. So it's still a recognition of private property. It just, eminent domain says the state can decide for the common good in a situation like that, that you have to sell it to the state. So we, again, recognized in our own constitution. So I'll just mention that here, eminent domain. So there's nothing in here about Robin Hood style of economic system. Let's rob from the rich and give it to the poor. Okay, number two, they did emphasize opportunity to have a job. Okay, now notice they're not saying the government goes and employs people or creates jobs, raises taxes, and says, we're going to create all these jobs and make it happen, where the government becomes the employer, in effect. No, legislation should help with creating a climate in which there will be jobs. So it's the right balance that a government has to have of encouraging this and not having taxes so high that it crushes initiative. And that's what's happening. It happens so often, the crushing tax burden, it's too great. But anyway, the opportunity to have a job, and again, we talked about the living wage. And yes, there is one other thing, is helping those who cannot work. A little bit earlier in my talk, I read to you how St. Paul says, if a man will not work, let him not eat. That's for somebody who can and just wants to be lazy. Well, then you have to learn the hard way. But there are individuals in society that, for one reason or another, they'll be out on the street. And what they seem to be saying is, don't just leave it all up to charity. There is a sense that we are part of a society and we need to be, to help take care of them if nobody else will. It's a principle of subsidiarity. Ideally, you would have more charitable organizations. in the heyday of before Vatican II, for example, you had orders of nuns that would work in hospitals and to take orphanages and so forth. Now, even they needed to be supported. Even they deserved to be, you know, to be able to live off of what they worked. There's a principle of justice there too. But it took a burden off the state. They didn't have to raise all these taxes because charity was already taking care of many situations. You know, even to this day, why is Catholic education possible? Because our good religious sisters who are paid less than people who have to make this living wage, they accept it, but they do it for the love of souls, and that's what makes Catholic education economically doable. We will forever owe the Catholic sisters for all that they do for Catholic education. There's so much in that regard. I can see Father wants to help me wrap up here. And I'm going to have to leave out a good part of what I have here. I'll try to get it taken care of in the next 5-10 minutes. But I think I've explained how the church's attitude is not laissez-faire, French word for just let it be, just let the laws of supply and demand take care of everything. We're not going to we're not going to address the human needs there properly. Now, if we did a continuum explaining the various degrees of government, we would find the problems, among the other problems with socialism and especially communism. The problem with socialism is the government takes over of much of the economy. And I don't need to quote a pope to tell you why that won't work. We can just look at our own experience. If you really want to bog something down and make it inefficient, what do? You turn it over to the government. Why is that so? Because they have no competitor. And that explains the gross inefficiencies under communism and under socialist states. Competition is a good thing. You know, it forces you to produce a good product, because if you don't, somebody else will. But when you monopolize things, it's a good way to ruin it. And we see this happening. Sometimes the government takes over more of the economy, and then it acquires a little bit of common sense and says, you know, we should privatize this, and it goes back to private where there's the competition can come in. Now, in communism abolishes private property and freedom. And the Catholic Church condemns both of these. Obviously, communism even more so than socialism. And I would just like to read this for anybody who says that Pope Pius XI was a socialist. This is what he had to say. Whether we make this pronouncement, this is in Quadragesimo Anno, we make this pronouncement, whether considered as a doctrine or a historical fact or a movement, socialism, if it remained truly socialism, even after it has yielded to truth and justice on the points which we have mentioned, cannot be reconciled with the teachings of the Catholic Church, because its concept of society itself is utterly foreign to Christian truth. Further on, socialism is based nevertheless on a theory of human society peculiar to itself and irreconcilable with true Christianity. Religious socialism, Christian socialism are contradictory terms. No one can be at the same time a good Catholic and a true socialist. Amen, brother. That's the Pope getting across. These, even though they emphasize these, they're just promoting, telling governments and all of us why we need to, or the attitude we need to have. And this is for our overall benefit, but we are not in any way advocating this or even going further to communism. So what's wrong with our system today? Just talk about our country because we live here. But these problems are endemic or systemic to every country that has socialism. And here's the problems. Number one, it's a godless system. That's the fundamental problem with our country. We are trying to solve our problems and address our needs without God. It's a denial of the kingship of Christ. And every civil ruler has the duty to get on his knees before our Lord Jesus Christ and Mary Immaculate Queen and say, "You are king and queen of our land." And yes, the state is supreme in civil matters and temporal matters, but it comes to moral matters, that comes under the church founded by Jesus Christ. But we unfortunately are not having that happen in our country. The inequalities of taxation is not a fair system that we have. There's a tremendous burden on those that are trying to be the entrepreneurs, and in many cases, I think, where people could at least pay a little bit of tax, no income tax at all, I think there should be a social a duty there of paying just taxes according to one's condition. Our government is too big and unresponsive to its constituents. It borrows too much. My dear brethren, it's not a thought I enjoy thinking about, but we're going towards bankruptcy. We cannot sustain. If I had more time, I'd put the figures on the board. And just if you want to know what you owe right now, each one of you personally, according to the USDebtClock.org, each person owes $53,533 as of October 11th, 2013. And not everybody's a taxpayer, so if we just do it on the taxpayers, each one owes $148,166. You know that's never going to be paid. So we're going to have to be paying the piper here very soon because we are living beyond our means, and there are too many programs, too much wasteful spending. We cannot sustain what we're doing. Our government is infringing on our Catholic conscience, which is not the least of these worries. It's the greatest worries. There's a plethora of laws and rules that are impossible to observe. You might call it a lack of common sense. And in this light, I would agree with President Ronald Reagan, who said, "Government is the problem, not the solution to multiplying, thousands upon thousands of laws." If I had time, I'd read for you about a man who tried to open up a lemonade stand in New York City. It was ridiculous. He's just trying to prove a point. You know, we've multiplied so many laws that it squelches innovation, creativity, and it's just government run amok. It's too much going on. It's the death of common sense, you might say. So, we always have to look at solutions. We always want to understand that. And a great book you could read, highly recommended as all of Chesterton's books are, written in 1910, What's Wrong with the World? He pointed out the four enemies of family. And this fits in perfectly with the teachings of the popes. He said, number one, or actually, I don't know how he enumerated these, but he said, the enemies of the family are big business. Big business where unchecked capitalism, which ends up concentrating wealth in the hands of very few and ends up oppressing the worker. So big business, big government, and that's even a greater enemy, I think. Thirdly, he called public education, which takes parental choice, takes choices away from parents that they should have and what their children are learning, and feminism. Feminism, breaking up the family so mom can have her career to the detriment. I'm not saying that, I'm being very careful here. Some women have to work. Some women should work. That what they do. I'm thinking of teachers, nurses, there's other areas where we do need women, but not where we say, let's just forget about the family, let's forget that the mother is the heart of the home, and let's take that away. Remember that, you know what's interesting, this book was written at a time, at the setting of Mary Poppins. You remember the story in the movie? Mr. Banks is at the bank. He's somewhat of a detached father. He's not involved with his children. And where is the mother? She's out being a suffragette. I mean, that's a real sad commentary in that movie. The mother just abandoning her role, and then to have the nanny take care of the mothering. So I think Chesterton was definitely trying to address that. So, and of course, this is what Chesterton had, and I think it just, again, fits in perfectly with what the Pope said, distributism. And that was Chesterton's teaching, favor small business. You know, big business will always be there, and it's not inherently wrong, but there are advantages to small business. There's a greater independence a person can have as a small business owner than he can as a corporate cog, which sometimes it turns out to be in a very large business. And, you know, this would be an easy way. You would just favor the business. Favor the mom-and-pop stores. You know, and this spreads the wealth more evenly through society. You don't need Obama's socialism to do that. Just encourage small business. Give them more tax breaks. You'll see many good things flow from that. I'm going to end with a handout, and I'm just going to wait 1 minute on that. But it's a rephrase of distributism, which I think fits in perfectly with true Catholic social justice. But real quickly, my suggestions for improvement: let's be aware of the ideal, let's promote it in the workplace and social settings. Contact your representatives. You know, encourage them to promote true social justice, not this atheistic socialism we've got going on in our government. Understand that work is a penance. It's the penance of daily duty, and oppose injustice when you see it. But anyway, if you could just start passing this out. But I'd just like to read, not the whole thing, but this is called Distributism, a 12-step program. Step one, begin by thinking like a distributist. A little-known but powerful idea called subsidiarity states that larger entities like states and federal authorities should not assume rights and responsibilities proper to smaller entities. Step two, look at your possessions. Which do you own and which own you? Possessions that give nothing and drain your checkbook are worse than worthless. Get rid of them. One person stopped tossing cardboard, kitchen scraps, and old potting soil. He now mixes these with composting worms and grows vegetables and fruits no money can buy, all on his apartment balcony. Step three, a billboard appearing nationally displays several small infants with the caption, "Children, our greatest resource." We cannot say it better. Married? Have a child. Have one? Have another. Keep having another one, as many as God sends. Find your joy in love and of God and family. You'll never regret it. Step four, stop working for your boss. No, we're not suggesting you quit your job. Rather, put your job and your boss in their proper place after the family. Step five, married? Get your wife fired. This is if she doesn't need to work, okay? Many couples have no idea what a working wife and mother costs the family, never mind the child care, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's just getting across the point. Step six, are you thriving or just surviving? Ever run to the store for something only to discover its twin on the shelf when you got home? Step seven, still working on Sunday when you don't have to? We know what the law is about that. No servile work. Even God knew when to quit. Step 8, resurrect the fine old art of bartering. Yes, the government hates anything that it can't be taxed. Don't you feel good exchanging something and the government didn't get a tax on it? I'm saying this because there's too many taxes. Step 9, learn to feed yourself. That's why we're growing St. Isidore's Garden here at the Mount. We need to have a better awareness, and when times get tough, we'll have real food. Step 10, children learn more by osmosis and less by lecture. Help them do the work proper to them by not stooping to do it yourself. Step 11, do your homeschool or send your children to private school. In other words, try to keep them out of public schools. Multiple problems with that. And then step 12, tell a neighbor about distributism. I think it's a good idea. Thank you very much for your attention. God bless you.